This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Improve your development skills by completing coding exercises that are peer-reviewed by real humans. Learn more at upcase.com.
I have a really important question for you.
Okay.
How do you feel about bagels?
I love bagels.
Okay. Have you ever seen a bagel slicer?
I have.
Like, you know, the kind that has like a little triangle blade and you push it down into the slot and it cuts the bagel?
They also sell toasters that have built-in bagel slicers in the bagel width toaster.
I've not seen that.
I think you have to be Jewish to know about it.
Okay. Well, maybe you can. Now I'm in, so I'm not even Jewish. But there's a guy that I'm working with now at the client whose father invented that bagel slicer.
Really?
Yeah.
So he must have like a bagel slicing fortune or
that's
something.
That's what I thought, but I guess he just worked on patents. And I asked, I was like, you know, personally I just prefer to cut my bagels with a bread knife because it's way easier that way.
Yes.
And he said, yeah, that's how his dad does it too. So there you go. Straight from the inventor of the bagel slicer. Hot take on the bike shed. The bagel slicer's out, use a bread knife. What have you been up to? Oh, you know, we have news. We have news. We haven't been on. I don't think we've recorded since we both found out that we'll be speaking at RailsConf.
Oh, yes. We'll speak at RailsConf.
Yeah. I'm going to talk about code reviews and how to do them well and the type of culture they create when you do them well. And what are you talking about?
I'm going to be talking about the Attributes API and the process that went into designing it.
Great. So if you're going to RailsConf, look for Sean and I. We're going to try and record a few live episodes. We have Tom, our producer, coming down with us, and he's trying to set up a room so maybe we can do some live recording there. So that'll be fun. Look for us there. Yeah. So what have you been up to this week?
So I'm starting a new Android project, and as it turns out, the entirety of everything related to tooling on the JVM is still completely broken, and mobile developers still don't care about testing as much as they should, just in case you were worried that that changed and our understanding of the world needed to go away.
I mean, I don't understand it from the... I only hear what I hear our iOS team talking about is that like they're frustrated that there's no real good high-level testing framework for like walking through your app. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about, or is it worse than that?
No, actually, in Android, we've got a really good integration testing framework. So that's not the issue. But when you've got, first of all, the compiled language, and you have to worry about class paths, and you have to worry about compile time class paths that are just used to verify type signatures and whatnot, versus runtime class paths where it actually loads all that into memory, because Android's huge, so it doesn't compile against the actual Android framework. In Objective-C, they have header files, which solves this problem, but we don't have header files in Java. So what they do is they provide a jar file that has all of the public API classes, like there, with all of the methods with the correct type signature, and then the bodies just throw new exception stub. But so you sometimes need Android for compiling. But not always. And you definitely want to make sure that's only a compile time dependency. And then your integration tests will run on an actual device. And that's really slow.
It'll run on an actual phone, like not in the simulator?
I mean, you can run it on a simulator if you want. But like a simulator is like it just needs to be something that is, as far as the tool chain can see, is an actual device. Because Android, the emulator, it's not treated any differently than a real device would be. And then you'll have dependencies that you'll want just for your really ridiculously slow tests that are going to run on the device. But then you'll probably want a second set of tests that are your unit tests for stuff that don't interact with the framework. And those will have a completely different set of dependencies, but they still need to depend on your main code, but need to not require Android for compilation. And so all of this requires a pretty complicated dependency setup, which... It actually looks like the Android tooling now finally is having good support for, but at the same time, the build tools, some of the public APIs changed in major non-backwards compatible ways. So all of the other plugins that interact with those then stopped working.
So it's painful times is what you're telling me.
Yes.
It doesn't sound too dissimilar from like Rails 2 testing days. right? Like where, sure. you know, if you wanted to use RSpec in Rails 2, then every time something happened in Rails, like your test suite was broken if you wanted to upgrade. So yeah, every time you wanted to update like Rails, then all of a sudden RSpec's broken, right? And you have to decide between whether or not you want to be on the latest and greatest or you want your test suite working.
Right.
So,
well, and then in Android, we have another problem, which is that older versions of the VM can't handle more than short maxval methods, like total for an application, which...
Total methods? In, like yeah. the count of methods?
Right. Okay. In the program file
okay.
that all has to get loaded into memory, it can only handle a total of short maxval.
Okay.
Which is much more of a problem if you're writing your application in Scala or if you're just using large libraries. You can actually get to that number pretty quickly in Java if you're using something like Apache Commons or just something that has, you know, tens of thousands of methods. And then the Scala standard library and core library is like 15,000, I think, something like that. And so now it's getting a lot better. It used to be the only option was to use a program called ProGuard, which looks at your compiled class files after you compile them and analyzes what's ever actually used, except that's not a perfect system, and you have to have special configuration to tell it, first of all, here are the classes that, from your point of view, are never used, but I know for a fact anything that subclasses activity, for example, is going to be used, so that you need to keep, and then keep anything that it depends on. But things that are relied on via reflection or whatever wouldn't get picked up as being used. And then your tests, which are compiled separately, you might have certain code or certain dependencies that are used in tests but aren't used in production. Like, for example, on Marshall Codex, one of the ones that we ran into a lot was we were using the mutable collections API to store results of some asynchronous stuff, which we're never using any mutable collections in the actual code. And so it drops all of the mutable collections when ProGuard got run. And so configuring that was always a pain in the ass. And there's a new thing called multidexing, which can be supportive natively in the application on 5.0 and later. And there's a polyfill for 4.0 and later, but it makes everything a lot slower. Except apparently the new tools are faster, but nothing supports the new tools. So
you're in this in-between state where you need to kind of wait for things to catch up to the new tools, sounds like?
Right. Every few months when I start a new Android project, I go look at alternatives to all the things that were painful and go look at updates to everything, and everything's gotten slightly better and then completely broken in a completely different way.
You have to learn new edge cases to work around.
Yes.
But like what you're talking about doesn't sound like those problems are specific to Android, but they're problems that like I don't know, like all the way back to like, oh, there can be a maximum number of methods, right? That's reminiscent of problems that we have in web development where you have like, not anymore, but where you had like a maximum number of selectors in Internet Explorer.
Right.
Or and you just had to know about that kind of thing. And there were tools that could help you with that. And then the talking about like ProGuard running and stripping out things you're not using, like, and you have to like instruct it like, oh, no, wait, I'm really using that, is like kind of like mangling and compressing your JavaScript, right?
Yeah. Well, and it does obfuscate as well. That's the other thing it does.
Right, because you don't want anybody reverse engineering your Android.
Your enterprise. Well, ProGuard's not an Android tool. It's just, like all of this is, certain problems are Android specific, but a lot of the tooling problems are actually just in general problems with JVM tooling, like tooling tools, build systems.
Right. And dependency management sounds like is
yes.
kind of a hell. They should talk to NPM. They fix that. So, yes, another one.
Yeah.
So lately, I've been just working on that same service-oriented mess that we've been talking about.
In Ruby.
Yep, in Ruby, and we're starting to make some progress. We killed off an app today. It was the first time. So we went from 7 to 6. So that's good. Taking small steps. And I started thinking about like I'm doing a lot of refactoring work right now, and it's super hard to try and stay in the I'm only refactoring mindset, right? Every little thing I'm uncovering, I find like, oh, but I could just, this could just be the, like from text on the page to like everything, right? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where I'm trying to go with that really, but but that was my current thing. Like just before I was coming down here, it was like, we're porting their sales funnel is what they call it. It's basically a wizard that you go through to set up this campaign on the website. And porting that over to, it was this gigantic Rails controller that's like thousands of lines long with everything happening in, like most of what you actually care about happening happens in before filters. And so you're chasing this thing all over the page. And so we're breaking that out into several controllers. And along the way, kind of like giving it a little bit of a design refresh, but not trying not to change the functionality. And right. I've had a really hard time trying to keep like my opinions on what the functionality should be to like a later time. Like, no, we've got to get it over on this new architecture. Then we can start. Oh, what if we did, you know, what if we just architected it a little bit differently? What if we just like got rid of this field and combined them into this other field? Isn't that so much simpler? So I think that takes like a, I don't know. Like it's really like Joe and I were working on it together. Joe Ferris, our CTO, is on the project for a couple days a week for the last couple of weeks. We were working on it together. And if not for him sitting right there, I think I would have gotten much further down in the weeds. And in fact, like I was working on it by myself for a good amount of time. Like I was working on this, I started this refactoring by myself. And when he came over, he was like, well, why are you also changing this? And I was like, well, because it was stupid and this is better. Like, you know, and so we kind of had to unwind some of those things and distance ourselves from some of that. So I guess my advice is like pairing in those situations can totally keep you sane and try and keep you focused. So,
yeah, I mean, it sounds similar to when I find some obscure feature in Active Record. And I'm like, crap, this ruins all of the refactoring that I'm doing because now I see why the code was written in this crappy way and it's only to support this crappy feature that was not well thought out. And on this new architecture, we can come up with a way better feature. But then I'll get hate mail.
Right. Yeah, you want to go fast, right? You want to be like, oh, let's delete all this old stuff and let's move on to the new stuff.
Yeah.
But it certainly takes a special – and like – there are people at Thoughtbot here who like really only want to work on greenfield projects, right? And that's like the allure of being a consultant to them is that we get a lot of greenfield projects. And there are people who are consultants that really love doing the refactoring. And so I don't know where I am. Like I think some days I really do really love improving a code base from something that appears to be almost insurmountable and just taking small steps and like trying to tell yourself at the end to like take a big picture look. Like from day to day, you can feel like you're not making much progress, but if you really take the time to look back at like where you were a month ago or 2 months ago, you start to see some progress. And
yes,
I just like that has its benefits too. So I guess what I'm saying is I enjoy them both. They just take totally different disciplines, I think.
I agree with that. I mean, if you just do greenfield, that can get boring pretty quickly. Because when you see, like, the big ugly code base, it's not – I mean, there are some code bases where it's just, like, the person didn't care about writing decent code and it's ugly for that reason. But, like, a lot of times it's just naturally grown into a monster by dealing with complicated problems. But I feel like most of the more interesting stuff doesn't come in the first 3 or 4 months.
Yeah. And this project certainly had a lot of, like – when I first came on, it was like, we need this one feature – in this dashboard area that needs to be implemented. And I implemented those and I was like, okay, you know, that was harder than it needed to be because of these various problems that we've talked about on the show, architectural issues. But, you know, so I suggested like, we can improve this architecture while we also make progress on these features over here. And then, so that was, you know, a couple months in, and then we brought on some people to the project and we're looking at it again. And we're trying to make some like, again, like they wanted to change how login works on the site. It currently works with an iframed, there's iframes involved and Ajax, and then the iframe gets closed and things happen. It's really hard to explain, and it's not how you would build a login if you were building it from scratch today. So we thought, like, okay, great, we can fix this, no problem. And we set out, and it just, again, one of those journeys where you're like, what happened to the sessions? Where are the sessions? People are not, like, everybody's logged out. Why is this happening? And that turned out to be totally unrelated to the work we were doing and was just because the session store was Memcache and it was filling up, right? So I was like, okay, well, that was a giant runaround. And then we make a little more progress on the login and we push it out and we're doing like some small testing. And we're like, why am I not able to, like, I have a login here and then I go over to this other application, which is on another server, and I don't have a login here. What's going on? And turns out those two different Memcache servers, right? Like they're not even they just don't share sessions at all, even though you think they will.
Right.
So like just various things like that let us down okay, now we're at the point where it's like, I don't think we can make reasonable feature progress, and we really need to Like, even though I was looking forward to, like, we'll implement new features and improve as we go along, the approach actually needs to be, we need to go really slowly and focus on quality. Anything new that gets introduced has to be of the utmost importance and the utmost quality. And right. then the old stuff, you just kind of have to keep chipping away at for a little while till you get to a point where you're stable. And that's what we're working on. Like I said, we're working on login, sales funnel stuff. I've had a lot of exposure to Devise lately, mm-hmm. which as the clearance maintainer, like there's been, so Devise is another, if you're not familiar with it, Devise is another username and password authentication, really just authentication library. Like it aims to do a lot more than clearance does. Right. And it's by far the most popular to use in Rails. And there's been several times maintaining clearance where I'm like, why are we maintaining clearance? Like Devise is so much more popular and people just use it. And there's like, you can Google for it and find like how to do anything you want to do, right? Because everybody's using it. And then all of my interaction with Devise recently has been like more of a boon to like my, like, yes, we definitely need to keep maintaining clearance. Like various things about it, like having to define the types of things that you're signing in via a helper in your route. So you have to like say Devise for users. And if you don't say that, you don't get a current user method. Like that kind of thing. So
that's just weird.
Yeah. Like you can't, there's no configuration. Like it's not a configuration where you say like, I expect to sign in users here. You actually have to say in your routes file, you say Devise for users. And now that's what sets up the fact that you have a current user and you have, you know, signed in, user signed out, like that type of thing. And then like Devise supports like signing in as a user, signing in as an account, signing in as all these other things. It's like, well, I mean, I guess maybe that helps some people. But.
Well, I think that's the tricky thing too, though, right? Because clearance is definitely way easier to use if you have a specific authentication need.
Right.
And the specific thing that clearance is really good for is pretty much what every app is going to need going out the gate. Mm-hmm. And then clearance stops being the greatest option when you need to really do something funky and have it be super duper configurable and handle anything. But then it's really hard to switch from clearance to Devise when at the point that Devise becomes a better option.
I mean, I don't know. I know that Devise and clearance both, I'm 90% sure, by default use bcrypt for passwords. So you like, if all you had were users and you wanted to switch back to Devise, you could do that. But like, even my experience with Devise has been such that like, I know a lot of work goes into that project, and I really don't like talking badly about people's projects. It's not, you know, a lot of people clearly do like. But for me, like I think if I had those advanced needs, I'd be looking at something else. Like I'm trying to think of what those needs would be. Like if you're actually trying to authenticate with like other services instead of having your own user store or something like that, I'd look for something a little more simple. Just from a Devise perspective, like I just kept having to jump in and be like, oh, what's this method doing? And then it turns out it's actually like you can't find it in the source. You have to like, you know, binding.py and show source because it's a metaprogrammed method, that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I think the things that Devise can handle out the door a lot easier than clearance can are the kinds of things that we've actively chosen not to support, like email confirmation or tracking, you know, restricting sign-in to a single machine, stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah, certainly. That's certainly the case. And we're trying, that's the thing, that's what I'm trying to focus on is like, I want clearance to be opinionated about the way that like user sign-in should happen and make it easier for like easy to implement, but also a pleasure for your users to use.
Right.
But I also don't want to get in the way. And I think right now we do kind of stand in the way of like, well, I don't want my sessions remembered all the time. I want to be able to check this remember me box.
Right.
And, you know, if that's checked, then, you know, they get a rememberable session. If not, then, you know, it's just good for the browser session. So like those types of things you can do in clearance, and we've made improvements there, but I want to make that stuff a lot easier. And then on the other side of the coin is like Simple Form. So that's another thing. It's made by the same company, I believe, right?
Yeah, Platform Attack.
Right. So we introduced that because we had a lot of markup in the forms that was duplicated, and it wasn't particularly handling like, how do you handle errors on this field in a consistent manner? And we were like, you know, it'd be really nice to have Simple Form. And Simple Form is getting it set up to, especially if you're starting on you have a project that like you need, you already have all these forms and you want it to meet the exact markup you're already doing. You have to get in there and you configure these wrappers that tell Simple Form how you want your forms output. And those are so frustrating to configure. The experience up front is really, really, I mean, there's just no way to say it. It's pretty miserable. But if you take the default configuration and you just run with it and you say, like, this is what my forms look like, and I'm going to write some CSS to make them look like the way I want, because the default configuration actually outputs you forms that are like markup that you are is pretty flexible, and you can do basically what you want to do with it.
Right.
So we ended up kind of splitting the difference and being like, well, we'll take mostly what it does by default. We'll tweak it where we have to like make it kind of easier to style to fit what we're doing. And there was a lot of upfront work to get that done. But now that that's done, being able to go through these pages of the wizard that I was talking about earlier and just be like, f.input this field, f.input that field, and know that the errors, and that's where, know that like errors are going to get handled. And if there's hints, we can render those and placeholders, and everything comes from like a canonical place on i18n.
Well, and when worse comes to worse, it also inherits from the Rails form builder. So you can always just fall back to putting some markup there and structuring it yourself, because all the building blocks are still available to you separately.
Right. And it's like, I feel like that was the experience of that was like frustrating to get set up. But then once it was set up, I was so thankful to have it. And I can't think of a better alternative to it, really. Like, right. Especially just like the Rails form builder works out of the box for simple needs. And then as soon as you have a lot of forms, or you need like, you know, to handle the case where you want to automatically, like, if there's an error on this field, put a class here and show this, like, that type of thing is not the kind of thing that the Rails form builder is good at. So,
no, definitely.
You know, I don't know. Those were just the two libraries I've been interfacing mostly within the last couple of weeks. And, like, Devise sent me, like, back to clearance, and Simple Form was maddening to get set up. But Joe was like, you know, the simple part of Simple Form is not the library itself or the DSL. The simple part of Simple Form is your forms when you're done setting that up, right?
Right.
So it was a lot of work up front, but I think we're going to get a lot of wins out of that. So that's mostly what I've been tied up with, I guess.
Well, actually, do you want to keep talking about forms? Because we can talk about forms.
I'd love to keep talking about forms if you have ideas. Like, we talked about, like, why is the Rails form builder, particularly errors, right? That's something that, like, the Rails form builder, like, why wouldn't that do that? And then I talked about, like, a number of years ago, I opened up a pull request that would, like, let the Rails form builder support placeholders through i18n by convention. Like, if there's a placeholder there in the i18n, just throw it in there. And that was closed because it was like, oh, we have all these other form builders that do this already. Like, just use Simple Form, that kind of thing. And I was like, well, forms seem to be the one place where, like, Rails is content to let, like, Simple Form is basically what people turn to, I feel like.
I agree, except, you know, a lot of people would say the same thing for Devise. As opposed to, like, has secure password. The Rails form builder can definitely be enough. Like, I know of an app, not naming any names, but that I know for a fact is just using the Rails form builder and not Simple Form. And if they ever in a million years felt like the Rails form builder wasn't sufficient to build an application with, there would be lots of changes happening to the Rails form builder.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
But I think the direction that's most interesting isn't so much the form builder, but the object that you pass to it and that works with the forms.
Mm-hmm.
I know we've talked about form objects a little bit in the past, but like when you get into other languages, they all have like completely different takes on forms, which are always very interesting to me. Like in Scala Play, there's not really an ORM, and the form object is what's responsible for validations. So you define how the properties of this object map to form inputs, and then what validations exist on the form inputs, which when possible will also automatically generate the appropriate HTML client-side validation attributes on the form tags, or on the input tags. And then when the data comes back in, you pass the request body back to this form object, and then it's responsible for returning either the data structure it was representing originally or a map of form errors.
Right.
Or then, like, you've got YSOD, which applies type safety to the URL, which just gets ridiculous. Because, like, you don't just create the form tag and you don't just give it a URL. You have to give it a route inside of YSOD, and then it's able to verify that that route exists. And then it's also able to verify that the content types that'll be generated by every single one of the inputs matches the expected inputs of that route.
What's the practical, like, implication of that? When would that not be the case, I guess?
I mean, when you have a typo.
Okay.
When you're doing params user mail instead of email, or you accidentally have a number field instead of an email field.
What does that have to do with the route, though?
Well, it knows what inputs in the request body the route's going to be looking for, or the action at that route's going to be looking for. Okay, so it knows that it's looking for a certain structure.
Okay, right.
Pat can, I'm sure, talk in more detail than I can because I'm only loosely familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then like Django has something similar to Scala Play where it's the same thing. The form object is what's responsible for validations. And so then it's the object that you pass into the templates that generates the input tags, and it's the thing you pass the data back into, and then that builds your data model out of that. But the validations all happen there, not going to the database. And then in everything that isn't Rails, I feel like anything that's data integrity type validations and not like sanitizing user input type validations always 100% of the time have zero support in the framework, and it's just make a constraint at the database level.
Right. But how does that, is that what Scala would do, right?
Yeah.
So how do you handle like messaging when you get back a, like, let's say there's a validation for, I don't know, uniqueness on a user ID on a table or something like that.
Sure.
Right. So how do you, so you let the database handle that. Does it gracefully handle and like the error that comes back from that validation so that you can display that to the user and be like, this user's already in this group or I don't know, whatever the, probably, whatever you're doing.
Probably not.
Yeah, that's always been the thing for me, like when I, because I do feel like I want, at this point, like the more and more I deal with this, like I don't want my active record models doing most validations. Like I'd much prefer the database to do the stuff that is required for data integrity. And then I want another object. I want these form objects to be doing, handling like user facing stuff.
Right. Name can't be blank.
Right. I want that. And I'm coming up against that on this project. Like I talked about that wizard, that multi-step wizard deals with the same object all along, right? So you're still working on the same object from the database all along. The validations at any one point are contextual. So if you're at this step of the sales funnel, you have these validation rules applied. If you're at the next step, you don't want the previous step because there's nothing the user can do about them if they're invalid at this point because they're looking at a form that doesn't have those fields on them.
Right.
So like the contextual validation thing in Rails kind of gets pretty ugly. You can have like a state field on thing that the validations are only applicable if the object's in this state, or the route that this project took is the controller decorates the object with a bunch of validations, which I think is actually reasonable. I think it's what we'll probably, for the sake of having the smallest change, probably pursue rather than having to write a form object. Like, that's pretty close to a form object, but without having to write a form object for something like that. And I would love to see, like, do you have ideas on what you think a form object could look like in Rails, like an officially supported form object kind of thing?
I mean, I feel like there's the parts that are obvious, like the fact that it will include active model validations.
Mm-hmm.
And that you will be able to read the attributes one for one of what your inputs are going to be, which may or may not map to one to one with the attributes of an active record model. The things that are then less obvious is I think that the form object should be able to really nicely support persist. Basically, first of all, every case that accepts nested attributes for would ever be used for.
Right. So why do we want? I don't know. Have we expanded on why we don't like accepts nested attributes before?
We can. I mean,
I guess if there's somebody listening who is sitting there saying like, what's wrong with accepts nested attributes for?
It gives a lot of behavior that you have absolutely no control over, and it will work very, very nicely in this one very, very simple case. And then as soon as you need any control over what attributes get assigned to where, if you want to delete or update existing records instead of creating new ones and you want that to work consistently, because the way you destroy it is not by not having it present in the attributes. It still needs to be there, but you need to put underscore destroy equals one.
Right.
Except if you then ever submit it with some of the records not in the array that you're passing to it. I don't remember what the specific thing we do is, but it's very, I remember it being incredibly funky and not a thing that you would expect.
There's like you have to say like, oh, allow destroy. And then you say like, oh, reject blank. Like if they didn't fill this out, then don't do this.
Yeah.
And so the API gets pretty big pretty quickly. And they tend to be like where you have one accepts nested attributes for, they tend to cluster. You're like, oh, I've got this one object that has all these associations. I want to do it on one form. And so you very seldom see one accepts nested attributes for, is my experience. You see like four of them on the same form.
Right. And I think it can work decently for a has one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But even then, ultimately, accepts nested attributes for is kind of the wrong abstraction because you're more – It's more like you're modifying a sibling than you're modifying children.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so then that's the other thing I think that a form object needs to support well is the mapping of multiple active record objects that might not actually be related at all, that you might have selected in some completely arbitrary way that wouldn't be visible to this thing as something as straightforward as an association. Like, I don't know, the current user and then that user's active organization's last authored post by a guest. You go, I mean, like some right. really arbitrarily complicated thing where you just have these two objects and you need to be able to map properties to them individually, but not necessarily know about how the association happens, and then save all of them, have good support for transactions and potentially nesting transactions. Composing other form objects would be very nice so that you have reusability.
How would you nest a transaction? What would you mean by that?
So if it's less that you want to be able to nest transactions and more that – so if I've got form object A that works with three objects, but one of those objects is another form object that consists of three objects, and they both want to ensure that they have a transaction for saving all of them, the inner form object still needs to, as far as it knows, be operating inside of a transaction. And then the reason that you want to fake nesting them or have them actually be nested where you have a transaction within a transaction is if there's after commit callbacks at any point in that chain, if you save record one and then a new transaction and then record two, three, and four, end that transaction and then save record five, you want the after commit callbacks for two, three, and four to have run before five gets saved. And then you want one and five to have their after commit callbacks run after the real transaction commits.
Do you want the after commit callbacks to be run?
I don't want the after commit callbacks.
Yeah, me either. But
there's legitimate use cases internally. Like one of the things that we're doing is batching up touch calls.
Yep, saw that one.
Which actually I'm pretty sure is just a smell of they've got their user model set up. So in after commit, it's user.comments.each.touch or %colon touch.
Right. So if you update your name, then everywhere you have comments on the site, they can expire that cache. That kind of thing. And we've run into that before. I think we had that conversation here before.
Right, and we swapped it around. We just, whenever we needed to display the user, we made that part of the cache key.
Right.
Which I feel like is the correct way to do it, but...
like we said, I think that API sounds really good, and I think if you couple that with take those validations off of the base objects that you're representing, put them on those form objects, if there's several form objects that need to share them, then... write them in a shareable way that you can compose these things with, like use the validations from this object rather, that kind of thing. And then the last, so then you don't have to handle what is my least favorite part of writing form objects is like, how do I handle errors that bubble up from the base object, right?
Right.
You don't have to handle that anymore because all your errors are on your form object itself. You don't have to promote them and figure out where you're going to display them on the form because the object is your form.
Right.
So that would make more sense. And the last piece that then becomes difficult is how do you handle when the database is not happy with a record? Because right now, the way you typically do it is if you're being thorough, whatever validations you put on your model, you back them up with the same type of constraint at your database.
Right.
So if you have a presence validation, you have null false in the database. Right. If you have a uniqueness validation, you have a unique index on the database. And a uniqueness constraint is not a user-facing validation, really. So you wouldn't think to put that on the form object, right? Okay, go ahead.
An average application might have three or four unique indexes. There should really only be one place that you have a uniqueness validation, and that's like user registration.
Sure, right. This user's already signed up.
But like you're saying, yeah, the majority of the time they have a unique index, it is not a user-facing error. If the constraint ever failed, it would not be something the user could recover from.
But it might be, right? So let's think of an application where you have a roster and you're adding people to a roster for your team or something like that, right? And you have the same person on the team twice, right?
So just don't have a UI where that's possible.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the other case is like, and then if you're screwing around with it, then, and you get some weird error from the database, then congratulations. So yeah, I mean, maybe that's more UI work.
The issue is it's really hard to actually generically handle something like the failure of a uniqueness constraint from the database because as far as we're seeing, it's just an invalid statement.
Right.
And so we don't get depending on the database backend, we might get more information than that, but it might just be we would have to parse the error message to figure out.
Like I know in Postgres, I think the error that comes back says that there's a uniqueness constraint validation. It might not be easily discernible which uniqueness constraint was validated.
Right. But ideally we'd get back an object with an error code that specifically gives us that information, because parsing error messages that doesn't feel like it's ever a good path.
No, then the adapter updates and, oh yeah, we're back in update hell.
Yeah.
I don't know. Every time I try these form objects, it doesn't, I'm left a little like wanting. I think that moving to a situation where we don't put any validations and we always on the base active record models and we always use a form object would be an interesting experiment to run on the next Greenfield project I'm on. So I might give that a shot if that ever happens again.
Yeah. And then I think it opens up interesting paths that we can take on the client side, or on the form builder side, I mean.
Oh, yeah. We talked about this from form builders.
Yeah.
Because then you're passing an object that's specifically designed to be built to build a form, basically.
Right. And so then, like, the way simple form infers what the type is of the input becomes much less, like, it can just do that because there's an object that's made to do that and not have to do all kinds of magic looking at internals of things.
Yeah, I do like the magic looking at internals of things, especially for like required attributes where it does, like, it'll put the required marker on a field if it's required, so it reflects on the object to figure out,
right,
does this have a presence validation, basically. So
and then ultimately, like, that all can still happen, but we've now structured the contract between these two objects that when you do validates presence of it, actually specifically modifies some input object internally to know that it's required.
It's something that you're expected to do, not something that, like, oh, look, I can reflect on this object, dig down through here, and right, then see, yep, there's a validation here. Like, whereas that's kind of a happy accident. If it were part of the design of the object, it'd be easier. And you can do more interesting things if you think about things that way.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. Should we just wrap up? I mean, we've been going for probably about 40 minutes. I don't know.
Yeah.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/11.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any of our other episodes, you can get in touch with us at hosts@bikeshed.fm. You can tweet at us @_bikeshed. You can leave comments at bikeshed.fm.
/11.
/11. Or any other episode. Send up a smoke signal. Whatever you want to do.
Thanks for listening to Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.
All right.